Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Washington College of Law here on the campus of American University. I'm Dan Metcalf of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy, and we're holding today our third annual assessment of transparency in the Obama administration. We're very lucky in how this has worked out, lucky in that we have the excellent assistance and support of our special events staff at the school that makes this sort of program possible, but also lucky in that the calendar has worked out very much to the advantage of this sort of program. We had what was then quite a novel program at the very beginning of the Obama administration, on January 29th specifically, 9 days in, looking at transparency and how the Obama administration would hopefully progress in a prospective way, in a very optimistic way, and frankly, because of the spectacular start of the Obama administration with respect to openness in government. I think there's no other word for it but spectacular, with the day one memoranda issued by President Obama, the reference to doing business in the light of day in his inauguration speech. That fueled very much the focus on things. And then we decided we were going to try to have an annual assessment program, and on January 20th of each year, a nice easy date to remember. And the second big way in which we were lucky is that Inauguration Day 2009 was on a Tuesday. And that meant that we had a Wednesday, a Thursday, and a Friday for three successive years. And we're still within a work week or a weekday time period for this program here. Next year, in 2013, given that this year, 2012, is the leap year, January 20th will be on a Sunday. There are really two reasons why we likely will not have this program on January 20th next year. One, because it's a Sunday. Two, because it is actual Inauguration Day and there'll be a parade in town. That'll be a distraction. And there are many people who are hoping there will not be actually a third reason for not having an Obama assessment program in the year 2013. We'll have to see how it goes. But what we're able to do is take a look back at the last year, the past year, I should use that word, and look forward to what might or might not be the last year, the fourth year of the Obama administration, and look at the highlights and the lowlights, the pluses and the minuses, and how things have gone and how people hope they might continue to go, or perhaps even improve in 2012. You all, I hope, have obtained a full set of the handouts that we have right up there at the top of the stairway on those tables. We have handouts in two types of forms. We have a disc that's prepared for continuing legal education, CLE purposes, and then we also have paper handouts here as well. And I would encourage you that if you haven't grabbed all of them as of this point, be sure you get them as we proceed throughout the day. Also, as part of the agenda itself, in other words, in the package that you automatically received when you came in this morning, we have the bios of all of our speakers. And that gives you background information and allows us the opportunity not to have to go into great detail and consume time with bios. We'll just count on you to be reading that and make only limited reference to the bios of our speakers. I should also emphasize that we have over the years, last year, the year before, even the year before that, we have taken pains to encourage as much as possible Obama administration speakers to be here, people from the White House, from the Office of Science, Technology, Policy, from the Office of Management and Budget, from the Department of Justice, and now NARA. The Archives is a big player with respect to the Office of Government Information Services. And we have been no less unstinting in that effort for this program today. We thought at one point we would have, as an additional luncheon speaker, the replacement for Beth Novick, who many of you know by reputation, who was the Deputy Chief Information Officer for e-government at the White House. But Chris Vane in that position was pulled away rather suddenly. We will have someone from the White House has been especially designated for that position, to represent the White House here. We thought at one point we might have a representative of either the White House or the Justice Department participating in the panel this afternoon on White House visitor logs, but that, as it turned out, didn't go that way. We do, of course, for the panel today on the controlled unclassified information subject, CUI for short, we're very pleased that we have the two leading officials of the Information Security Oversight Office, ISOO to its friends, and we have many friends of ISOO here, and they'll be speaking on that panel. And with respect to OGIS, that is such a significant topic that in balancing the program content between today and FOIA Day on March 16th, we're going to have an entire panel devoted to OGIS on March 16th. So we'll be covering that very, very well and very, very fully that day. But I also want to acknowledge that, as many times in the past, we have the director of OGIS, Miriam Nisbet, in the audience. And I've told Miriam that she can have more impact, even from a seat in the audience, than some of our panel members can up here or even at the podium. And as a matter of fact, let me just emphasize, too, that we do have our next program on Friday, March 16th. It is Freedom of Information Day, James Madison's birthday, and we also have flyers for that up at your next to the other handouts in the foyer, and I wanted to just extend the invitation for those of you who want to plan on hearing Miriam and her people speak about OGIS, amongst other things. We're going to have a high visibility FOIA litigation panel, and we're going to have a panel on congressional issues with respect to freedom of information. We are going to, for the first time ever, have all four corners of Capitol Hill covered. By that I mean to say, have the principal legislative staff persons from the House and the Senate, the majority and the minority, on a panel that day. It's going to be hosted by Tom Sussman, who goes back to the olden days on Capitol Hill, the 1970s. What we do also is try at these programs to have a mixture of old and new. And by that I mean to say the usual suspects, the people who have spoken at our programs before, as well as new folks as well, who have interesting perspectives to share. And sometimes we wind up even having a pair of people from the same organization. You'll see that on a couple of our panels today, and there are two panels that have someone from the Sunlight Foundation. We do that when there's an especially strong impact that those organizations are having in a particular area. What we'll do today is focus primarily, very heavily, on how the Obama administration has fared up to this point, especially in the last year. And I can start it off just by way of introduction, say that this has been a year of reports of progress. Now it's the third year. And the results of the reports and of the progress, the assessment in general, I think can fairly be summarized as mixed, or mixed as best. As a matter of fact, I'll just run very quickly through some of the headlines in recent months, talking about how transparency is elusive, how there are signs, and I'm quoting here from headlines, signs of openness, how the Obama administration fulfills some open government goals, how it has paid some open government dividends, how, and this is one of our principal organizations here today, opengovernment.org, says that the Obama administration makes transparency gains, but challenges remain. Also says that the White House released an impressive transparency report, but then someone else says, well, the glowing White House transparency report omits the first 8 months and skews the story. Someone else says there's been slight improvement at best. Another headline, open government, not yet. Progress and pitfalls, that's OMB Watch talking about progress to date, progress and pitfalls. Another one of our speakers today from Politico said that the administration struggles with transparency. AP says little transparency progress. DOJ flagship initiative lost at sea. Some people apparently didn't get the FOIA memo. And my favorite is turning aspirations into reality. Because why is that my favorite? Because it segues so nicely to our keynote speaker this morning, who is Frank Reeder. And Frank is positioned as well or better than anyone to speak to that subject, because Frank was a very senior member of the Obama-Biden transition team. He worked on multiple team, I guess you'd say, particular teams dealing with government performance, government activity, transparency in particular, personnel matters, based upon his extensive background. Frank started at OMB, believe it or not, in 1970. And he was just telling me a little bit earlier, he started in the government in 1961. He has seen it all. He was the head of the Information Policy Section. Actually, it's now called the Information Policy and Technology Branch of OMB, which has major government-wide policy responsibility under the Federal Record, Paperwork Reduction Act. He was the head or director of the Office of Administration of the Executive Office of the President for 2 years during the Clinton administration. He has held the senior positions during successive presidential administrations, Republican, Democratic, makes no difference. And he also, for those of you who care, as some of us do, very intensely about the Privacy Act of 1974, Frank was involved in the negotiation of that law and also in the development, he was responsible for the crafting of the initial OMB Privacy Act guidelines that some of you may have used in your work from time to time. So it gives me particular pleasure to introduce Frank to get us off, launch us to a really good start this morning with his keynote presentation, which will talk about aspirations and hard realities and how it's difficult, maybe more difficult than it might otherwise seem, to move things forward in the way that one might like. Please join me in welcoming Frank Reeder.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Yeah. Good morning. Thought I'd lost my hearing. Probably am. I'm delighted to be here. Dan, as I hope you have noticed, has put together an extraordinary program, and to be uncharacteristically humble, because humility is not the first adjective that usually comes to mind when people describe me, I'm really flattered to be in the company of the folks like Patrice and some of our other comrades in arms in a battle that we've been waging for some time. I'm going to violate a couple of the basic rules of speaking, at least two of them. One is never insult your host, because you probably won't be invited back. Ricky Gervais apparently makes a living doing that, but I don't have any of his other talents.
Consider this a standing advance order to come back next year, Frank, no matter what you might say. You can do that. Don't worry.
Be careful what you wish for.
Okay.
And the second is, one doesn't begin a speech or a presentation with an apology. With respect to my host, now at least twice in his introduction and on the program, Professor Metcalf insists on referring to me as senior, by which I learned he means old. But as an indication of his callow youth, he apparently does not remember the last time that January 20th fell on a Sunday, which was 1984. Happens every 28 years, for those of you who are into numbers. And in fact, while the president indeed is sworn at noon on the 20th, the parties aren't until Monday, so that If you're going out to Pennsylvania Avenue on the 20th of January next year looking for a parade, you're not going to see anything.
On that Sunday.
So for those of you who are planning your calendars that far out and are going to have a party, slip it to Monday. But there will be – the president is indeed sworn because, of course, under the Constitution, the president's term ends.
Does that mean, Frank, that we cannot have the fourth annual assessment of the Obama administration transparency on Monday the 21st? If we have to wait until at least the 22nd.
I suspect it would be sparsely attended.
Okay.
At least it is my hope that it would be sparsely attended.
Thank you.
For reasons not having anything to do with the quality of the program that you put together.
And if it's a Romney or a Gingrich program, would it be even more sparsely attended? Never mind.
An event I prefer not to imagine at this point. You can probably tell from my bio that I am shamelessly partisan. The nice thing about having been an appointee and no longer being a civil servant is I do have First Amendment rights, and I exercise them with great vigor. So Dan asked me to begin this convening with an overview or an assessment, and I'm not going to do what he asked me to do. And I'm not going to do it for three reasons. That's the purpose of this convening, and I hope at the end you will reach that conclusion, that the terrific panels he's put together will provide you the data on the basis of which you can decide for yourselves. Most of the people here are still awake and reasonably adult, and it's my view that I don't need to do your thinking for you. Second, I have a basic rule on accepting speaking requests and interview requests. I prefer to do them on subjects about which I actually know something. I don't always do that, but I don't pretend to be grounded in what has been going on in the last 3 years, certainly to the extent that the folks at the Sunlight Foundation or Patrice and her colleagues are. So look to them for real information. And third, I never do what I ask to do anyway, so why would I differ what I vary for that? So, okay, am I finished? No, because Dan's made the mistake of giving me airtime. So what I propose to do in the next few minutes that we have together? First, as a baseline for the conversation, I'd like to go back 3+ years and talk about what was the agenda. What is it that we are evaluating against? What did then Senator and candidate Obama say? What were some of the early commitments that the Obama administration made? And second, I'll talk a little bit about some of the challenges and barriers that they then faced in making good on those commitments. Third, I'd like to talk a little bit about about the world going forward. What are the drivers? How is the world changing? What can we expect to see, one hopes, in the next 5 years of an Obama administration, but certainly the drivers that will influence whoever has his, and I think it will now be a he, hand raised on noon on January 20th of next year. And I'll leave a few moments, if I can control myself, to talk about, to invite you to throw out comments, questions, rants. My experience with groups like this is that people tend to give speeches in the form of questions. I invite that. So what actually happened? I ran into a delicious quote yesterday, and if you get nothing else from the next 20 minutes, mark this one down, because I did, and you'll want to use it. You know, for years we've used the Santayana quote about history, right? Those who do not study history are condemned to relive it, right, or words of that effect. But I ran into a delicious quote from an author I wasn't familiar with, but I'm going to get familiar with him in a whole big hurry, named Julian Barnes, whose book The Sense of Ending won the Booker Mann Award in 2011. And he says that history can be found at the intersection between imperfect memory and inadequate documentation. I bring the imperfect memory, so understand that. The good news is actually, in the current world, the documentation is getting slightly better, although it is, if you will, in some senses harder to deal with because there is so much of it, and its provenance is not always apparent. So, you know, but I won't turn this into a conversation about critical thinking. So what did candidate Senator Obama say that he would do? Most of this is found, if you haven't read it, it's actually worth a reread, in a document that was released, I believe, in Grand Rapids in September of 2008, in which he laid out what was effectively the insider's agenda. That is, how are we going to run this thing as opposed to what it is, most of these other speeches, which focused on what the administration hoped to accomplish for the American people. And clearly, I won't read it to you in its entirety. One I thought was particularly interesting you can quote me on this, woefully naive. He led with making the legislative process more open. Why, as president, he thought he could be any more effective than he was as a junior senator from Illinois eludes me, but that was one of the first promises that he made. Specifically, the words are, end the practice of writing legislation behind closed doors, and we know how much that happened, but to his credit, it's not clear what a president can do about that. But with respect to the executive branch, he made a number of commitments that I think are worth going back and looking at. One, and here I'm quoting, Barack Obama will require his appointees who lead the executive branch departments and rulemaking agencies to conduct the significant business of the agency in public so that any citizen can see in person or watch on the Internet as the agencies debate and so on and so forth. One has visions of you know, the public, you know, visiting the president as they used to do at the White House. The same thing, I guess, with the image that conjures up, that same thing would happen in the agencies. Second, actually building on work that he and Senator Coburn had done, legislation that had been enacted when he was a senator, and I think a significant accomplishment, he said, we're going to build on the successful bipartisan Google for Government initiative, that also known as, I think it has a fancier acronym, most of us refer to it as Coburn Obama, to create a user-friendly website that provides the details of government spending. Very specific commitment to build that out. Here's one that we'll have a little bit of fun with. As President, Barack Obama will not sign any non-emergency bill without giving the American public an opportunity to review and give input on the White House website for 5 days. Pretty specific. A little bit of an aside there. I asked one of the principal authors of this piece, who was in Chicago at the time. I was working on the transition team. I've told some of you, the stealth transition team, because, of course, candidates don't have transition teams, right? Because it's presumptuous to assume that there's a possibility that you could be elected. So there were about a dozen of us working in Washington on a project that didn't exist, because the expectation the public has is that the candidates wake up on the second Wednesday after the second Tuesday, the Wednesday after the first Tuesday in November, saying, oh, my gosh, I'm president. What do I do now? So we were working on that, but the campaign was pretty much separated from the transition team, except for the linkage at the top. And I said, my words were, what the hell were you guys thinking? I mean, for reasons that I'll elaborate, that's bizarre. It can't happen, and it can't happen for a number of very good policy reasons. And the answer I got was one that I used frequently, so I really had no comeback. You should have seen the first draft. So So with that, I accepted this a very good person who later served in the administration, his assurance that indeed they had rolled back some of them. But in essence, the candidate had made some very, very ambitious commitments to openness. So what happened? Dan's already alluded to the memo on day one, actually. It was issued on January 21st. It's important, using a double negative, not to underestimate the significance of that. During a transition, especially the transition for a president-elect with an agenda as ambitious as Barack Obama's, there are 100 candidates for first day items. Everybody says, but, you know, back in X, the president, the then candidate said this, we've got to issue this. So there's a serious sifting process that goes on, because one of the things you learn very quickly, those of you in communications, is you don't step on your own story. You don't put out 50 stories in one day because it dilutes their impact. So it becomes important to send a message about what you think is important by limiting the number of things you say on the first day. Because if indeed the president had issued every first day initiative that was before him, not that he disagreed with any of them, it would have been meaningless. So the mere fact that there was a presidential memorandum on January 21st is non-trivial. It says the candidate, now president-elect, and then when he put his pen to paper president, actually thought this was important. And clearly his record in the Congress would support that. He didn't wake up as president-elect and say, oh, openness, that's an interesting question, tell me about it. There's a story, however, behind that memo, and if I've told it before to this group, my apologies to those of you who've listened to it before. So let me tell you how that memo came about. I had the joy of serving, as Dan said, on several teams. The transition was organized functionally and organizationally, so there were agency teams, and I served on both the White House team, because I had been in the White House, and on the OMB team, dealing with essentially the performance and technology agenda at OMB. I also served on a functional team called, it was the TIGR team, the Technology Innovation and Government Reform team, which had in whose portfolio was the openness initiative. And there were some really great people on that team. And the first draft they produced, the openness memo, ran, I think, to about 10 pages. And it described at great length all the processes that the administration was going to set up. And I had the joy of doing something that I had made a living doing in my career in the 18 acres. I wrote one of my The Emperor Has No Clothes memos. On the Hill, you started by saying, Senator, somebody signing your name to really, things that are really stupid. But, you know, whatever the form is, you ultimately say, nah, you really don't want to do this. And you don't want to do this for a couple of really important reasons. One, presidents don't issue 10-page memos. Presidents set a direction. They establish principles and values. They hold people accountable. But they don't issue detailed memos. And there's a good reason for that, because you can't possibly, in the confines of the 18 acres, do the staff work necessary to think things out in that detail. Second, there was a very serious flaw, and I'll come back to that in a moment, substantively in that memo, in renewing one of the commitments I just read to you. And the third was, we're doing an openness directive by going behind closed doors and then issuing it? Sounds to me like the people we just booted out. That indeed, if the administration was going to have an openness initiative, the first thing it needed to do is establish an open process by which it would then develop the openness directive. So the openness directive is not what was issued on day one. What was issued was a presidential memorandum establishing principles and setting hard deadlines by which the president's science advisor and the director of OMB were to come back to the president after having done extensive consultation. So let me, because it's great fun, poke at one of the specific commitments that the candidate with all good intentions made in September that almost got out in this memo. We're going to give the public 5 days. Now, I believe that there are a number of people in this room who have legal training and may even have once upon a time stumbled upon the U.S. Constitution. You've read it?
I think we have a copy in the library.
Ah, good, good. Well, I believe the Constitution actually provides the period that the President has to consider legislation that has been enrolled, that is, has been passed by both chambers in identical form. Okay. And there's a process by which that occurs. Actually, you'll be interested to know, it doesn't always occur when the second chamber completes it. It's when the clerk, when the enrolling clerk in the House actually inscribes the bill and delivers it. So at the end of a Congress, when there are lots of bills passed, it may be weeks before the last bill reaches the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, and it's at that point at which the clock begins. Okay? So the President has 10 days. What happens in those 10 days? Well, first, OMB sends it out to all the agencies that have a dog in the game, if you will, a dog in the fight, to get their recommendations, to get their views on what the President ought to do. And if they recommend veto, what the rationale is for that, including a veto member, if they and the lead agency, and usually it's pretty obvious which agency has primary responsibility for legislation, what a signing statement or perhaps even a signing ceremony for major legislation ought to look like and who ought to be there. That material is due back on usually a pretty tight time frame, anywhere from, depending on how weekends intervene, because these are working days, not calendar days, 2 or 3 days at most. OMB puts that together and prepares what is called an enrolled bill memorandum to give the President and his staff a couple of days. I mean, you don't send things over to the President and say, sorry, boss, you've got to sign this in the next 10 minutes because otherwise, you know, it becomes law without your signature or you pocket vetoed it because the Congress, they used to recess once upon a time. They don't do that anymore.
Back in the day, yes.
Yeah, well, so in any event, so that's how those 10 days are used. As you can see, it's a pretty tight time frame. Even more significantly, for all but very minor legislation, that's not the first time the policy apparatus has thought about the legislation. Again, it's not like, oh, we got this bill, what should we do about it? The administration has been looking at draft legislation. We have, I think there's a bill having to do something with intellectual property floating around. I see it's getting a little ink. The administration's been weighing in on that. It has been considering it, it has been expressing publicly, and more importantly to the Congress, what the President is likely to do in the event that the legislation reaches his desk. It's been negotiating, it's been recommending changes. So the position of an administration is pretty well defined. There have been occasions when the enrolled bill process brings to light concerns that might not have surfaced before. But on major legislation, there are seldom surprises. And more importantly, and here is maybe the second little nugget that I invite you to take away that has nothing to do with the subject of this conference. The worst thing you can do in this town is surprise people. One of the things I learned in my congressional experience, both representing the legislative branch and then later when I was a Hill staffer, is that there are lots of people up there who violently disagree with one another. But, you know, with some notable exceptions, they seldom surprise each other. You let people know, you face up to people with whom you disagree and let them know. Now, we saw, particularly on the debt reduction debate, and I think Speaker Boehner had a problem. I don't think Speaker Boehner was being duplicitous. He really thought he could make a commitment. But that's a serious no-no. And so in the enrolled bill process, the notion that a president can, at the last minute, say, oh, well, that statement of administration policy that we set up a month and a half ago on this bill that said we would support with these minor amendments, and you made these amendments, never mind. I really didn't mean that. I went out and got a bunch of new comments on it, and we've done a de novo review of the whole issue, and everything we said before is, in the words of the Watergate hearing, no longer operative. It doesn't work. You simply can't do that. Even in these horribly contentious times, the political system works because there is some openness and there is some trust, maybe not as much as we would like, left in the system. So as a practical matter, the notion that the president could open the world, open legislation to the world, and as a consequence of that, seriously change his position. He can ask for comments, but in point of fact, though, that he can commit actually to taking serious account of those comments. There was also a third small problem. I don't know if you've heard of this, but we have this thing now called email and social media. And people have figured out how to communicate. And when you take a piece of major legislation, even if they don't, you know, shut down Wikipedia, or, you know, hang black crepe on Google, they will communicate with you. And I would submit, maybe lesson number two, is the worst thing you can do if you really want civic engagement is ask for people's input and not have the capacity to deal with it. Because there's also a trust relationship between those in positions of responsibility and those with whom they engage. You know, if I'm perfectly happy if you're going to take responsibility to make a decision, make it, but don't ask for my opinion and then ignore it. You don't have to heed my opinion. Asking for input doesn't carry with it a responsibility to accept that advice, but it certainly carries with it an obligation to take it seriously. In fact, leaping to a subject about which I know almost very little, if you think about the theory that underlies the Administrative Procedure Act, it says agencies have to take account of comments. They can't be arbitrary and capricious. They can't throw them on the floor. Doesn't mean they have to heed them. And if 99% of the comments argue for going in the one direction, but the agency has, I love your word, colorable argument for going the other way, it has the authority to do so, provided it can demonstrate that it has taken comments seriously. The same attends, while it's not a legal requirement, but certainly is a political requirement, I would submit, to any process that requires civic engagement. In any event, so the first day memo, I think, was absolutely terrific, but it was an example of that first instance where political and I think sincere aspirations met reality. What are some of the other things the administration did? We then finally had the openness directive that, you know, Beth Novak and her team developed through a wonderful open process, and then the submission of agency plans. I'll leave it to others to evaluate those. In April, I believe it was April or May, Attorney General Holder issued the memorandum essentially reversing the previous administration's position on the standard that the Justice Department would use in defending FOIA cases and returning to the Reno standard. A third example of something that I think is terribly important and indicates that the administration had learned something was the way it handled health care reform. If you think about why health care reform in the Clinton administration failed and why it succeeded in the Obama administration, I think it was largely as a consequence of the process that they used, the relative transparency of the development of legislation, and some would argue perhaps less aggressive leadership than the Clinton administration did, leaving things far more open. But nonetheless, ultimately, they got legislation. Now one only hopes it withstands forces currently at work. So what are some of the barriers that the administration faced? First and foremost, I've already belabored it at some length, this huge leap from what you think can be done to what can actually be done. The second, which is a corollary of that, is practicability. Some things seem like very good ideas, but the 10-day review, allowing the public 5 days to comment on enrolled legislation, is simply not practicable, unless we amend the Constitution and introduce that. You think we could? No, I don't think so. Third, there is, for lack of a better term, and I am or was a bureaucrat. It's not a pejorative term in my vocabulary, but it's certainly bureaucratic inertia. As the agency plans reflect, it's one thing to articulate a bunch of principles. It's another to convince, you know, probably don't have to convince all 2 million of them, but you have to convince a substantial segment of folks that this will not significantly impede their ability to accomplish what it is their agencies were set up to do. And finally, there are political realities. And here, you know, the case in point, while it's not directly on the question of openness, is what happened to the candidate Obama's commitment to close Guantanamo. Yeah. I don't think, at least I don't argue that that isn't a good idea on its merits, but in point of fact, the political cost, if in fact they could even have accomplished it, of moving those trials to the mainland, if you will, was ultimately determined to be unacceptable. You can argue with whether that was a conclusion or not, but certainly administrations need to deal ultimately with the political reality, and unlike campaigns, it's not a matter of convincing the people leaning your way. It's a matter of bringing the whole system along. So what are some of the drivers that I think are going to change the world going forward? One, I've already alluded to, but I think we need to keep the sailor's term, a weather eye out. This is an instance where the camera is changing the picture. Not only has technology changed the way we grant access and make government visible to everyone, it continues to do so. And I'd cite two specific examples of that. One is the emergence of these things. The app phenomenon has blown me away. I guess I didn't appreciate until I saw a presentation about a year ago by a senior official from the Department of Health and Human Services talking about access to medical information, saying, yeah, the paradigm has shifted. We've got to make sure that these tens of thousands of people whose creative energies are going into developing applications have access to our data, because they'll add the value that makes it useful to the citizens. Now, that is not an argument for governments abdicating its responsibility, but it's, if you will, in words of one of my colleagues, both and. It's a matter of enabling this incredible intellectual energy that exists this may be a neologism, in the atmosphere.
It's in the cloud, actually.
Pardon?
It's in the cloud.
Yes.
If you look to the southwest, you can see it, the cloud.
So I can actually, I always wondered where it went, but it's actually, I can see
it. I didn't know until someone pointed it out to me. So the southwest, that's where it is.
You've passed the test. I always, succession is useful to me if I've learned something, and now that's phenomenon number one. The second is the WikiLeaks phenomenon. Now, we can have an interesting debate on the legality and morality of what Assange did and is doing. Set that aside for the moment. The practical reality is that the assumptions that we have historically made about keeping information on close hold, confidential, whatever term you want to use, simply no longer apply. Whether you agree with the Holder memo or not, whether the next administration, one hopes not, attempts to retrench, as a practical matter, we don't any longer know how to keep it a secret. And what is beginning to happen, the early efforts of the ISU were based on the understanding that the more stuff you classified, the harder it was to contain it. The more people who had classification authority, the more difficult it was to contain it. It wasn't. But that's, if you will, on steroids now. Take that, the extent to which those pressures will exist and our ability to control information, while one likes to, the technologist in me says, oh, well, we'll find a technical solution. No, we won't. The folks writing cables in some outpost characterizing a foreign leader dare no longer assume that those cables won't see the light of day sooner than the standard declassification period. Now, that also will have, and I suspect already is having, significant impact on behaviors. Unless you're a fool or a masochist, I suspect each one of you thinks about what you put into an email. Because once it's there, it's there. And even if you've said for eyes only, and even if you've applied in the environment in which you operate all of the techniques that are available to constrain access, you have to assume that those at some point will be breached. And if you don't, as I said, you're either a fool or a masochist, and you decide what you are. Finally, and this is the note on which I will conclude, we've got to change our vocabulary, and I've become a shameless advocate for this. I serve on a board of, by the way, for those of you who don't know, when you serve on the board of a not-for-profit, the first question you need to ask is, how much will this cost me? So I'm not peddling anything. Fortunately, this is not financially remunerative, of something called a collaborative governance, not government, governance research institute. And the basic premise of what that entity is attempting to do is recognize that there is a large set of public policy problems. You know, certainly global warming is one. Climate change, right?
Mm-hmm.
We don't say
politically correct. Yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I wasn't being PC.
Or if you say global lukewarming, I think that equally qualifies.
Okay, that's
yes.
Thank you. That's two. The stuff is up there in global lukewarm. I'm stealing these, and I'm not attributing them to you.
Yes. Don't let anyone say that I'm meteorologically challenged.
Good. So
just challenged in other ways.
But the problems of that ilk, healthcare, real healthcare reform, not that what we've done so far isn't significant, but rethinking the entire healthcare delivery paradigm, not just the healthcare financing paradigm, which is what the legislation 2 years ago did, is going to require intersectoral collaboration, which goes beyond government consultation. So let me leave you with a continuum, with the beginnings of a new taxonomy or a new paradigm that suggests that openness is the beginning. It is the revealing. And by the way, giving credit, the previous administration was absolutely terrific at telling people what they'd already done, mm-hmm. except if it involved torturing people. But for the most part, they were actually, once we've decided something, we'll publish it. White House website was absolutely awesome in that respect. The second tier, and every problem isn't susceptible of this, is what I would call consultation. That is, I have a responsibility by statute or otherwise to do something. I need the best advice of the best people I can engage to help me figure out how I ought to use that discretion, how I ought to discharge the responsibility I've been given. That's what the APA was about. And over time, we often call that civic engagement. But that, at least to me and some of the folks that I work with, that's not collaboration. Collaboration is shared accountability, shared risk, and understanding that solving the healthcare delivery problem, dealing with global lukewarming, thank you, dealing with what we're going to do with open spaces in our community. These aren't all big mammoth problems. Some of them are small and very local problems. Can only be dealt with through a collaborative process that says, I'm willing to come to the table and in a legal sense give up a little bit of my sovereignty, give up a little bit of control and say, all of us are going to pay, all of us are going to benefit, but we can't get the larger public benefit unless we're prepared to do that. Thank you for inviting me. Do we have time for a question or two, or a rant, or
as a matter of fact,
tomatoes, please?
We have a little bit of time. I don't think there's any fruit. These terrific insights you've given us, Frank, but let me use the moderator's prerogative and just ask one particular question to start it off, and then if other folks have questions, we have the mics on each of the two sides of the auditorium. You can just come up to the mic. You made reference to the openness in government directive, which was issued in December of 2009. There's a little known provision of that having to do with backlog reduction, Freedom of Information Act request backlog reduction, and basically establishing a pretty firm requirement of 10% per year. And there's also a reference to OMB in relation to that. And there hasn't been much discussion of that since then, or attention to it as near as I can tell. I testified before the House last March, and I noticed that in the preceding year for which the statistics were then available, the Justice Department itself had not a backlog reduction. Actually, his backlog had increased a little bit, and in its leadership offices, AG Justice, Associate Attorney General, and Deputy Attorney General, the backlog had increased by 33%. Do you think, based upon your experience at OMB, that OMB can indeed play a role for government-wide FOIA backlog reduction as seemed to be contemplated in that memo?
The risk of ruining my reputation and giving you a one-word answer, no. Mm-hmm. And let me explain why and then suggest a path forward, because that's not a very helpful answer to your question. There is, and I don't attribute this to you, a naive assumption that because OMB is asked to do something because it controls the purse strings things, it will get done. OMB is a relatively small place, and it, too, has to decide what its priorities are. And it seems unlikely, even though I think, you know, Cass Sunstein was a terrific appointment, that this will ever rise to the level of the priority that it would have to have for, essentially, in the budget process, somebody to say, you don't get money unless you meet this objective. And that's ultimately the only instrument OMB has. You know the credo at OMB is the carrot and stick approach?
I thought it was the stick and stick approach.
You hit them across the head with the stick and you poke them in the eye with the carrot. So what can you do going forward? There's an interesting phenomenon. I apologize for giving another anecdote. What we found in the Clinton White House when we built out whitehouse.gov, which, by the way, had been, you know, was absolutely amazing at its time, was guess what happened to mail? Paper mail. Went up, went down, stayed the same. Left the volume. Anybody think it didn't go up?
No, we've got smart people in this audience.
Yeah, and so what the technology is enabling is all the media now are used more. So I suspect in the short to medium term, the transparency of government only triggers more requests through whatever channel they come. So the real challenge, it seems to me, is to be much more creative than we, and I still think of it as we, have been in forestalling requests by making information more accessible. That's what eFOIA was about. I don't think eFOIA has been especially successful. The theory that underlay that was if you get it out there, you know, among other things, if there are things that are frequently subject to requests, then publish them rather than have people ask for them. But I think we simply haven't devoted the creative energies, and maybe the atmosphere is one way of doing that, to giving people channels that will reduce the volume. Because in my view, ultimately, the FOIA is a channel of last resort. Mm-hmm. And for most, it's still the channel of first resort.
Okay. We have time for, I think, just one more question. And the gentleman over there has a microphone that will work, I think, if the button is pushed. That's what I'm told anyway.
So my question relates to the difference between grand principle and then enforcement of those principles. And the title of your talk, Aspirations, From Aspiration to Hard Reality, sort of perhaps captures the potential difference. There's sort of two ways to take that title. One, the positive way, the administration is acting in good faith, and then it confronts hard reality. The other, which often relates to transparency is motherhood and apple pie. You'll never find anybody who doesn't aspire publicly as a politician to transparency. But the difficult thing, is implementing it. And that clearly is the case in the Obama administration on the difficult cases where people are looking for information that don't make the agencies look good. They're simply ignoring the mandate. And there's no reason not to, because there's no enforcement. There's no penalty for blowing it off. Mm-hmm. That's just the nature of FOIA and the way it is. Do you have any ideas to actually have meaningful enforcement of these great principles that have been, you know, laid out? So maybe if somebody's blowing it off, they'll lose their job or be fined or something like that in some meaningful way, where there aren't any of those costs right now, the way it's been actually implemented. That doesn't mean there's great progress in open government on the easy cases. But the test is the hard cases, and that's where the whole system is not working.
And regrettably, and I'm not doing this twice, the short answer is no. I don't have any, largely for the reason that I mentioned earlier about OMB, that I'm trying to think of the form that enforcement would take, and the form that enforcement would take would ultimately be to penalize individuals or programs who are doing work that we want them to do. So in that sense, who was the wonderful former senator from New York who was once accused of having set his face on fire and putting it out with an axe?
Al D'Amato?
Yes. So enforcement, qua enforcement, I don't think is a viable strategy. What I think, again, the path going forward is finding and rewarding things that work and holding them out there and saying, you know, you can satisfy the public's right to be engaged in ways that do not have the adverse effect on you and your programs. Will folks ultimately still be disinclined to reveal information that doesn't show them in a favorable light? Of course. The other thing, and this is a leadership public administration conversation, not an information policy conversation. Something I've been, I would argue, even evangelizing and certainly writing about for some years is helping folks, whether you're a, you know, GSX clerk or, the secretary of a cabinet department, understand that revealing bad information or disclosing that something adverse, that puts you in an adverse light, is absolutely the smartest thing to do. And that the typical reaction, cover up, deny, blame, whether you're Gary Hart off on some peccadillo or a president of the United States who didn't have sex with that woman or some other event, is only compounds the problem. And I think we've got to build that into the culture, and that, so both of those strategies, finding models of success and changing the culture, which doesn't mean there still won't be ugly, adverse congressional hearings. I used to love being the designated spear catcher on those. That's inevitable, but that comes with the territory, and you learn not to take that personally. Great question, but the short answer to your question is I don't think enforcement works.
Well, Frank, thank you very much for getting us off to such a strong start for this program. We appreciate it very much, and we'll now roll right into our first...